Americans are durable. We take pride in hard work and high quality. American Giant makes durable, quality clothing right here in the USA. Because what we wear reflects who we are. When you buy American Giant, you're not just wearing the best clothes money can buy. You're helping keep jobs and pride in your own backyard. Premium clothing built to last decades, like it should. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code RIGHTHERE24.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Galazzo, joined as always by Peter Flaherty. What's going on, Peter?
I'm doing well. Today was the first really for every day in the next 4 months where I went outside and the cold actually hit me. So it's going to just be freezing cold and 6 hours of sunlight for the foreseeable future in New England. So it was a little bit of a sad day, but yeah. Other than that, I'm excited to dice it up about the AL West.
Last Sunday or two Sundays ago, whenever we changed the time, whenever we skipped forward or skipped back, whatever it was, we got an extra hour of sleep. My wife was very excited about it, and I was not at all, because I hate when the sun goes down at 5 p.m. It's super brutal. I also had to do morning cardio inside on a treadmill, which is... it just makes the cardio sessions even more miserable than they already are. So yeah, I'm not looking forward to the cold, and it's hit us here as well in Northern Virginia. So I'm not quite as cold as you probably up there in Boston, but I can commiserate with you a little bit.
It was like in the 20s this morning.
Oof. Okay. Yeah. I can not complain at all. We're 30s and 40s so far. So. We're still good, but we're back to talk some draft reviews. We got AL West draft classes on the docket today. This is going to be a Peter specialty. All these classes are really college heavy. Peter, I counted this up before we got on the show. If you had to guess how many high school players were selected top 10 rounds with all these teams, what would your guess be?
Well, that's a good question. Five teams in my prep as well. I didn't necessarily count. I did know it was college heavy. I'm going to say 17.
Top 10 round high school picks. 17 is your guess?
Let's say 14.
Five is the correct answer.
Five? Oh my gosh.
Five high school players cumulatively between the Astros, the Angels, the A's, the Mariners, and the Rangers.
In the top 10 rounds?
Inside the top 10 rounds.
Wow.
I will note them as we go through them, or I can just mention them right now. It probably is better to note them as we go through them. But yeah, a couple of these teams that just straight up college exclusive drafts in the top 10 round range. All of them are college heavy. Some of them took a single high school player. It's very light on the high school demographics here for these teams, but that doesn't mean they're not fun classes, just a little bit more boring than they could be in my mind. But for Peter, he loves that. So,
hey, I won't knock him for it. I know Ryan Sloan was the biggest one, I'm assuming.
Yeah, he's the big one. But let's start with the Astros. The Astros had one of the smallest pools. I actually think they had the smallest pool overall this year, picking towards the back of the first round, not having a second round pick. Not having any extra picks. They were picking 28th overall. They went with Sam Houston catcher Walker Yannick. In the third round, they took right-handed pitcher Ryan Forcucci out of UC San Diego. In the fourth round, they took right-handed pitcher Parker Smith out of Rice. And then in the fifth round, they took Liberty University right-hander Cole Hertzler. So a college-heavy draft for the Astros. Also, notably, a lot of small school college players. None of the players they picked in that range there were Power 5 inside the first 10 rounds, actually. I don't think they had a single Power 5 conference player. It was all smaller conferences. It's kind of interesting. I wonder if that was intentional or just happenstance for them. But it does seem a bit odd to not have a single player drafted from like an SEC or an ACC when you're really college heavy. That was notable to me. But what are your overall thoughts on the Astros here?
I like the class. Like, I'm a fan of the class, and the Astros, along with Seattle, who we'll also talk about, are they kind of fall in that bucket where you look a little bit extra close at who they're picking and maybe the ideology behind it, especially on the pitching side. So I had an eye towards the pitchers here, but starting off with Walker Yannick, who they took 28th overall, I know both you and I were pretty high on him going into the 2024 season, and we got even higher on him as he performed. He had a career year last year. He had 364 with a career high 17 home runs, 15 doubles, 58 RBIs, swiped 13 bags, and that was on the heels of a really good summer on the Cape. Pro debut was a little, it was a debut to forget. He kind of got, I mean, there's a big time period of adjustability, especially when you're, I mean, they sent him straight to high A, but he hit 175 with 30 Ks and 97 at bats. The miss rate overall was 35%, including 45% against sliders and 50 against a really, really limited sample of curveballs. Chased at a 33% clip. So I guess in a similar breath to Jacob Cozart last week, how worried or not worried are you about Walker Yannick's debut?
It wasn't super encouraging. I mean, he was one of the higher players up in terms of chase rate, in terms of miss rate of the debut hitters. I like you said, I really liked him prior to the draft. I still like him quite a bit. I think he's got the safest package of defensive tools to make him a valuable big leaguer in some capacity. We had plus on the fielding, plus on the arm. I'm hopeful that this is just kind of him floundering a little bit in a brief pro debut. I mean, we thought the contact skills were solid before the draft. I'm not going to get too concerned. It's not ideal, obviously, but so much of the reason why I liked Walker Yannick is because I don't think there's really a ton he needs to do offensively to have some major league value. Now, obviously, you want him to be like an impact everyday regular. That's why you drafted him in the first round, so you do have to hit a little bit, but I'm not going to get too concerned about him too much. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm in a similar feeling as you with Yannick, I think, and really any catcher who's sort of an ace defender, I think anything that you can do with the bat is almost just a bonus. Obviously, you would like it to be a little bit more than 175 with a pretty high K rate, but he's really, really solid back there. He moves well laterally. The arm is plus. He threw out, I think, 11 of 36 base stealers in high A Asheville, which is a 31% caught stealing rate. I mean, that's really good. So again, you want to see more with the bat, but I think defensively is where he really stands out. And he's already showing that at a, at a high level. And I have all the faith in the world that will continue to do so. And
He just does everything behind the plate. He receives well, he moves well, it's soft hands, he blocks well, he throws with power, with quickness, with an efficient exchange, with accuracy. Ultimately, like I had the expectations that he'd be an average hitter with maybe average power. Still hopeful he can get to that, but we'll see, I guess, what happens with the offense with him.
Yeah, but shifting focus to the arms, one guy, and sort of similar to a Yannick, where I really liked him coming into the year, was Ryan Forcucci from UC San Diego. Season got cut a little short due to injury, but he was excellent in his five starts. It was a 2.1 ERA, 37 Ks to just six walks and 25 innings. He's a really good athlete on the mound. Fastball up to 97, 98 with a lot of carry at the top of the zone, mixes in an above average slider that I think he has a solid feel for. And it's effective against righties and lefties. I think the key for him is just the continued refinement of a third pitch, but in the Astros system, I mean, I know they're going to do a really good job at developing him, and he's already a dynamic mover, and they're going to get the most out of his stuff. So I think that that's a very Astros type of pick. And I think that they got great value on him as well in the third round.
101st overall pick, signing him for basically $1 million. It's $997,500 officially for us, but that looks like the $2,500 signing bonus contingency was probably applied to him to get him to an even $1 million. But I remember you really liked him in the spring. He was trending towards like first round territory. If he would have been healthy, I imagine he would have been a day one pick conservatively if he had just kept pitching like that. He was looking at a career best strikeout rate or he had a career best strikeout rate in those 25 innings and five starts, 38.1% K rate. Both the fastball and slider, I think, look like above average pitches, and the control looked like it could be above average as well. He's flashed curveball and changeup, but yeah, I'll be curious to see what the Astros are able to do with him and just how healthy he's able to be moving forward, because when he was on the mound, he looked like just a well-rounded starter package.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I do believe in his ability to start as well. I think he'd be a really good potentially number three starter if he can reach his ceiling. And another arm that I liked that they snagged in the top five rounds was Liberty righty Cole Hertzler. Mm-hmm. More of a physical power look than a Forcucci, who's this leaner, athletic build, like really smooth delivery on the mound. Like, there's a ton of power with Hertzler. He's 6'4", 235. Fastball up to 98 with, again, life through the zone. And I think with him, the calling card are his secondaries. I think his slider, curveball, and changeup all had miss rates over 30% last year. His slider is this power gyro look that's effective against righties and lefties. Changeup gets, it's more of a separation pitch off his fastball. It'll sometimes flash some fade to the arm side with some tumble throw to righties and lefties. But I think it averaged over 11 miles an hour off his fastball. And then he mixes in this power curveball as well. So it's a really interesting pitch mix. I'm even more interested in it given that he's in Houston's system and just their development track record. He had a solid pro debut, across two appearances, 1.8 ERA, 6 Ks in 5 innings, both out of the bullpen. He made last year at Liberty was his first full year in the rotation. He threw the ball really well, I thought. I'm curious to see what they do with him. But regardless, it's a really exciting arsenal and just overall package on the mound.
Yeah, he's an interesting one. Another player who had a strong debut for the Astros was Joseph Sullivan, who was probably the best offensive performer for the team. Seventh round pick, out of South Alabama. He hit 250, 416, 324. So not a ton of average, not a ton of power, but he walked more than he struck out. He stole 8 bags. He got caught 4 times, which is a little bit surprising for him. He'd been a really effective, high-efficiency, stolen-base kind of guy in college. I think 85% success rate for his college career. I'll be curious to see how he plays defensively, because he played left field a lot in college with Will Turner on the same team playing a lot of center field. In his debut, I believe he played mostly center field. Yeah, 8 of his games came in center field, 2 in left field, 3 in right field. I don't think he's the kind of guy who would have enough power really to profile in a corner. He hit 13 home runs in 2023, but 9 in 2024 with South Alabama. Just doesn't seem like he's this sort of impact guy, but he's fast. I imagine he has the speed to play center field. The on-base skills have always kind of stood out. His swing decisions have always been strong. He's always shown a willingness to take a walk. It's a career 436 OBP, and yeah, that's against South Alabama competition in the Sun Belt, but it was good to see him kind of continue showing those traits in pro ball, and he's one of the kind of few hitters they have in the top 10 rounds here.
Yeah, I'm happy you brought up Sullivan. He was another guy I was going to touch on. It's just fun tools across the board. An intriguing pro debut, I guess you could call it. Nothing like super loud, but he did flash a lot of the tools that help propel him into that mid to late day two selection. And I think looking at day three, one, I guess, arm to keep an eye on is Ryan Verdugo.
Yeah, he was the guy I was going to mention. I thought he was the most exciting day three pick.
Yeah, it's a... Just in general, and the fact that the Astros took him makes it even more exciting. Cal State Bakersfield righty, 2.7 ERA at school with 93 Ks and 89 innings. But I like the stuff as well. Mm-hmm. Fastball won't – it's not insane velo-wise, but I think there are some somewhat outlierish traits to it. He's up to 95 with it. He'll average over 16 inches of ride from a 5'3" release height, just explodes out of – jumps out of his hand. Ton of life and carry at the top of the zone. His slider's a really effective off-speed pitch. It averaged 14 inches of sweep, a little bit over it. It'll have 2-plane till. It's a swing and miss offering, and he supplements it with an effective curveball that's, I'd say, pretty distinct in shape as well. So I think for them to get Verdugo on day three, and for, I'd say, just almost slot value of what they give him, like $173,000. I think that's
Looks like they paid him like $25,000 more than the max on day three without coming out of the bonus pool. So I think that's a solid one. I really like the breaking ball. It's like you mentioned, it's got a lot of spin. It's got a lot of depth and glove side movement. I think with a little bit more power, this could be a legitimately dominant pitch. I mean, I'm not sure if they'll try and turn it into more of like a true sweeper. It's kind of been a slurvy in between breaking ball in the past at times, but whether it's like a legitimate curveball, legitimate slider, he can clearly spin the baseball at a pretty high rate. So that's an interesting one as well.
Yeah. Just a really fun ball of clay for them to work with developmentally. And then also just from a fun standpoint, Bryce Botcher, who is a 13th round pick. He's also a standout linebacker on Oregon's football team. I think he leads the team in tackles right now, and they're number one in the country. And if he doesn't lead the team in tackles, he's right up there for the team lead. So that's pretty cool. He's got some power from the right side, big physical kid. Just a fun pick.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the Angels. Always a fun organization to break down after their draft. They have a type, they stick to it. They draft these guys and they move them quickly up the minor league ladder. This year they picked 8th overall. It was funny, ahead of the draft, we were kind of just constantly speculating who are the Angels going to take? Were they going to take someone outside of the consensus top 10, pay them under slot, move them quickly? Christian Moore wound up being that guy. He wasn't too far down the board, though, on our rankings. He had done a really great job moving up the board all spring with his performance at Tennessee. But he's the pick at number 8 overall in the second round. Chris Cortez, right-handed pitcher out of Texas A&M. With their compensation pick at 74, they took Ryan Johnson, right-handed pitcher out of Dallas Baptist in the third round. Left-handed pitcher Ryan Prager out of Texas A&M, who they did not sign. One of the handful of players in this year's class, top 10 rounds, who didn't sign. In the fourth round, they took Austin Gordon, a right-handed pitcher out of Clemson. In the fifth round, they took Dylan Jordan, high school alert, Peter, a right-handed pitcher out of Vera High School in Florida, one of our 5 top 10 round high school pitchers. But I think you can also give credit to the Angels for signing Trey Gregory Alford in the 11th round for $2 million. He was the biggest day three signee this year. Obviously, it makes the class feel a little bit better that you sign a guy like Trey Gregory Alford in the 11th round, who we had as a top 100 ranked prospect in the class after not signing Ryan Prager. But this class would certainly feel a lot better if they were able to get a deal done with Prager, because he just had a really good combination of control, deception, 3-pitch mix, starter track record, and to not have him in this class is definitely a bit of a bummer. But what are your thoughts?
The Angels have lately become really intriguing, just given how quickly they'll move guys through the system. And we saw it with Nolan Schoenewell, Zach Neto, 2 big leaguers and 2 everyday big leaguers at that, Neto being a really good one. And then this year with Christian Moore already in AA, David Mershon, 18th round pick already in AA and in the Arizona Fall League. But how crazy am I for still not being, I guess, sold/all the way in on Christian Moore? And I know that might sound crazy. And when listening,
I don't think that sounds crazy at all.
Yeah, he hit .322 in AA with 4 doubles, 5 jacks. Everything on the surface looks great numbers-wise, but in digging in a little further, I still have the concerns that I did at Tennessee just about the pure hit tool and the hit ability. This year, it was in AA, it was a 35% miss rate, 30% against fastballs, 48% against sliders. I know he got off to this blazing start. Like he was only in Rocket City. I think he played 1 game in July and then the rest was August and 1 game in September. So
yeah,
he got off to this gangbuster start.
He hit 6 home runs in his first 8 games, I believe. And then after that 8th game, he hit, I don't know if he had a single home run in the rest of the stretch. Yeah, if you just look from his 9th game to his 25th, he hit .246, .316, .304. Comparing that to his overall .347, .400, .584 line, like that kind of tells you how loud and crazy his first handful of games were and how much power he got to in such a brief period of time. I remember that debut. Like it seemed like he was homering every other second. But at the end of the day, you look up, it's a 29-9 strikeout to walk rate. You mentioned the miss rates. He was still pretty aggressive in terms of chase. When we had like Christian Moore in the second round, I really liked him. Thinking about him maybe being a guy who should push into the first, and then he kind of kept trending higher and higher and higher on the draft board. And I think just given the year he had, I think there are some people that maybe are overstating like the pure hitting ability that Christian Moore has. He always had some strikeout concerns his first 2 years. It was like 25% plus strikeout rate, and he did a really good job cutting that his junior year and getting to the 30 plus homers that he did. But I do think you're going to have to live with a little bit of swing and miss with a guy like Moore, who certainly has the power to make up for it. But yeah, in terms of like what sort of pure hitter you're getting, I think there are still some questions there, and I'm not sure where you're at on him defensively. But I think he needs to do some work on the defensive side as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's second base only for sure. If he's going to stick on the dirt, but yeah, with the hit tool with Moore, I'm with you. Like there's always going to be, some, I guess, strikeout issues, you could call it, and some swing and miss with his game. And I also think it's important to realize that he went straight to double A and did do this. So it might be a little bit harsh, but I think that,
yeah,
you know, these are issues that he's going to kind of have throughout his pro career. And once guys kind of figure out how to attack him and, you know, get used to seeing him in the box, I'm curious to see how and if he's able to adjust. So I think that, you know, he's able to impact the baseball. That's really not a question at all. I'm just curious to see how the hit tool progresses and how he's able to adjust as he continues to kind of climb through the pro ranks. So I think that when you dig under the hood a little bit, there are still some concerns with, you know, the same concerns in the lead up to the draft. But I think if you're the Angels, you have to be happy with the pick, at least to this point. You sent him basically straight to double A after two games in single A, where he went 6-11, and then he did what he did in double A. So hard not to be happy with it. I think in the second round, Chris Cortez, I was surprised that they snagged him in the second. He was one of the best relievers, if not the best reliever in the class. I just felt like it was a little bit of a reach, but you know, if they had intel that he wasn't going to be there, by the time their third pick rolled around, and that was a guy that they really, really liked and wanted.
Yeah. It is a bit weird, I guess, to see Chris Cortez in the second and then the Astros getting a guy like Ryan Forcucci in the third. I would just think like the starter upside with Forcucci maybe makes him a little bit more appealing a little earlier. We ranked them pretty close together, 88 for Forcucci, 90 for Chris Cortez. I am really enamored with the stuff that Cortez has. I mean, that's obviously the calling card for him. It's a lightning arm from the right side. He's been throwing upper 90s for a long time now. I think he averaged around 98 miles per hour. He's got this turbo sinking life on the pitch. I think the slider's really good, and I've seen the changeup good as well. I don't know how much of a consistent piece of his arsenal that's going to be moving forward, particularly if he's going to be developed in a bullpen role. But the Angels clearly like fast moving, hard throwing pitchers. They've taken a few of these guys in the past. Ben Joyce has been better than I expected him to be already in his pro career. I'm not sure if Chris Cortez is like the same sort of profile that Ben Joyce is, but there's certainly some similar traits here.
Yeah, like you said, it's a bowling ball sinker, power slider. It's plus with a lot of sharp sweep. It's a guy that kind of screams fast mover to me, and it's hard to not kind of picture him zooming through the system. With their third pick, they took Ryan Johnson from Dallas Baptist. Plus control slider, it's tight with a lot of sweep. You could stick comfortably a 55, definitely closer to a 6 than it is a 55. I think it's actually a, for me, it's a plus pitch. I think the key with him, he's got premium velo. I think that they just need to make some refinements and to the shape of it to maximize its effectiveness. It didn't get a ton of whiffs throughout his time at Dallas Baptist. So I think that that's some rather low hanging ish fruit to clean up. But one of the picks that I'm most intrigued with in the seventh round is Bridger Holmes from Oregon State.
Bridger Holmes, what a freak this guy is.
Oh my gosh. So he kind of exploded onto the scene last year at Oregon State, 47 Ks in 32 and two thirds innings with a 1.93 ERA. Like, really intriguing and kind of powerful east-west profile from his submarine slot. He's up to 94, which is really, really unique. And he pairs it with just this insane frisbee sweeping slider that's had spin rates up and above 3000 RPMs with over 24 inches of sweep. Like it's a unicornish type of look, even from his submarine slot.
Yeah, the release point and the tremendous amount of horizontal break he's able to get on both the two-seam fastball and the slider just makes him a really unconventional look for hitters. In his pro debut, the results weren't the greatest. It was a 5.09 ERA and 12 relief appearances, 17 innings at low A. But just in terms of the pitch shape, I mean, he averaged more than 20 inches of arm side run on the fastball that averaged 90 miles per hour, was up to 92 in his pro debut. You mentioned getting up to 94 from that slot previously. And then the slider averaged basically 19 inches of glove side movement with more than 2,800 RPM spin. It's just a really unusual profile. I would definitely love a player like this in the seventh round. They signed him for $215,000. He could be just a really freaky sort of odd look in the pen. If he can add a little bit more command moving forward, I think that'd be really helpful. He was like 4 walks per 9 with Oregon State in a pretty limited sample. The control was a little bit more erratic in pro ball. It's a definite reliever profile, but one with just really, really outlier sort of pitch traits.
Yeah, it's kind of as fun as you can get from a reliever standpoint. I think another pick that I was really intrigued by in the sixth round was Peyton Olynyk from Miami of Ohio. 6'11", 210 pounds, like a stiff wind could blow this kid over. But I mean, it's a really unique body type, obviously, at 6'11". I think you can fill him out and bulk him up a little bit more to maximize the velo and stuff. But he's up to 95 with 16 inches of ride through the zone from a 5'7" release height. And he pairs it with this mid-80 slider that he has a good feel to spin. It's got some teeth to it from a similarly low 5'5" release height. I just think that there are a lot of, I'd say, unique traits just about, you know, the body type and the stuff itself. Strong pro debut. He made 4 starts at Inland Empire, but I think he averaged like a tick over an inning per appearance. But struck out 11 across 6 1/3 innings, only allowed 2 earned runs. Like those are 2 back-to-back really intriguing picks.
Yeah, and let me just hit on a couple high school players since we won't have a ton of time to talk about high schoolers today. But Trey Gregory Alford in the 11th round, we ranked him, I think he was a top 100 prospect on the board. Let me see exactly where we had him. 98 overall, so just sneaking inside the top 100 for us. He is a big physical right-hander who's fairly young for the class, just turned 18 shortly before the draft, 6'5", 235 pounds. He gets into the upper 90s pretty consistently. Again, another fastball with a lot of life on the pitch, a lot of arm side movement that leads to a lot of just poor contact, ground balls, weak ground ball outs. The slider is another pitch that could be a plus offering for him. It's been in the mid-90s with really good power for a high school pitcher, gets under barrels. He uses it for whiffs in the zone and chases out of the zone. So the fastball slider is kind of the bread and butter with him. Spotty strikes, he's going to need to add a little bit more in terms of control and command moving forward, and maybe develop the third pitch. The changeup has not been a huge part of his game to this point. So getting him in the 11th round is just a lot of upside that you're grabbing. They paid to get it, but I liked that pick. And then Dylan Jordan in the 5th round, we ranked him as a top 200 player in the class, but another high school pitcher with some physicality, with some velocity now, and really good feel to spin the ball. He's not quite as big as Trey Gregory Alford is, 6'3", 205 pounds, but he's been up into the mid-90s with the heater. And then I think for Jordan, the slider has kind of long been his bread and butter offering. It's a really impressive breaking ball that got a lot of plus projections, a lot of sharp lateral break. He gets a lot of ugly swings with that pitch. And I think even more than Gregory Alford, you want to see more in terms of changeup development. You want to see more in terms of control. If his control was a little bit better, he would have ranked maybe as a top 100 prospect as well. But that's going to add some reliever risk, but certainly some upside potential with these high school righties.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think you hit on it perfectly. And then the last guy I think that's worth mentioning, and we brought him up at the start, is David Mershon. Small switch hitting infielder from Mississippi State. They threw him right into Double A. Thought he handled himself fairly well. He hit .254 with five doubles, having a solid fall in the Arizona Fall League, or had a solid fall at this point now that the season's over. Hit .260 with a double, a couple of triples, more walks than strikeouts. Just a good baseball player. I think that it's a boring way to describe someone, but I'd say that the best way to describe Mershon, just a really tough nosed kid, plays the game really hard, solid contact skills, just again, kind of a bulldog competitor. That's more like, nothing really stands out from a tool standpoint. Like, he can run a little bit, has a knack for putting the ball in play, but I think just worth mentioning given the path they've got him on.
Yeah, absolutely.
No team wins the World Series without having great teamwork. And teamwork can also protect your financial legacy and your family's future. SelectQuote's licensed insurance agents are the perfect teammates when shopping for customized, affordable life insurance. They can find you the right policy to keep your financial legacy safe. SelectQuote is one of America's leading insurance brokers with nearly 40 years of experience helping over 2 million customers find over $700 billion in coverage since 1985. Other life insurance brokers offer impersonal one-size-fits-all policies that may cost you more and cover you less, while SelectQuote's licensed insurance agents work for you to tailor a life insurance policy for your individual needs in as little as 15 minutes. You invest so much time to take care of yourself and be the healthiest, best version of you. SelectQuote's exclusive policies can reward that effort. If you're in good health, they work with carriers that get you a same-day coverage for up to $5 million with no medical exam required. And these policies are more affordable than you may think. You can get coverage for up to $1 million for as little as $20 per month. Head to selectquote.com and a licensed insurance agent will call you right away with the right policy for your life and your budget. SelectQuote, they shop, you save. Get the right life insurance for you for less at selectquote.com/BA. Go to selectquote.com/BA today to get started. That's selectquote.com/BA.
When creating your own business, the most important part is your ideas. So why let the headache of registering your business hold those ideas back? It's time to learn about a great idea that will keep you going and growing, LegalZoom. LegalZoom has everything you need to launch, run, and protect your business all in one place. Setting up your business properly and remaining compliant are things you want to get right from the get-go, but you don't have to strain your brain or wallet. LegalZoom saves you from wasting hours making sense of the legal stuff. At LegalZoom.com, you can take care of business legal needs in just a few clicks. And if you need some hands-on help, their network of experienced attorneys from around the country has your back. Over the last 20 years, LegalZoom helped start, run, and protect millions of businesses. LegalZoom, now you're in business. Launch, run, and protect your business to make it official today at LegalZoom.com and use promo code BASEBALL to get 10% off any LegalZoom business formation product, excluding subscriptions and renewals. Expires 12/31/24. Get everything you need from setup to success at LegalZoom.com and use promo code BASEBALL. LegalZoom.com and use promo code BASEBALL. Disclaimer, LegalZoom provides access to independent attorneys and self-service tools. LegalZoom is not a law firm and does not provide legal advice except where authorized through its subsidiary law firm, LZ Legal Services, LLC.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's move on to the A's. So we have them picking fourth overall this year, like all these teams. Another college heavy, college performing heavy draft class. They took Nick Kurtz with their first round pick at 4 overall, signed him for $7 million out of Wake Forest. In the second round at pick 40, they got Tommy White, third baseman out of LSU. In the supplemental second round at pick 73, they went back to LSU and got left-handed pitcher Gage Jump. In the third round, they took Rutgers shortstop Josh Carota-Grauer. In the fourth round, they took California outfielder Rodney Green. And then in the fifth round, they took Portland right-hander Sam Sturr. So The theme for the A's was college performers. A lot of their guys were just impressive in terms of their production in college, their draft year, throughout their careers in college. Nick Kurtz is one of the most impressive all-around hitters in the game. I was not really expecting, I guess four was a pretty obvious home for him for a while leading up to the draft, but he was kind of consistently more in the 5 to 10 range for us on our draft board. But I was excited to see Kurtz be the first college first baseman off the board, just given the conversations we had had, just kind of preferring Kurtz to Jack Caglione. And he has done nothing but continue to solidify himself as a really well-rounded hitter in pro ball. He hit well before going to the Arizona Fall League, and then I think he's also done well in the Arizona Fall League. And the fact that they signed Kurtz for a significantly under-slot bonus at pick number four, they saved almost $1.4 million towards their pool signing him there. I mean, he's played just as well as everyone who's kind of going in the range around him, and better than Charlie Condon so far, who signed for tied for the most money in the entire draft. But enough from me about Nick Kurtz. What are your thoughts on this class, Peter?
I think that the Kurtz pick now looks even better given how he's performing, but in the lead up to, like, it's plus hit, plus power. The approach is really impressive. Like, it's clear advanced pitch recognition skills. And I think for him at 6'5", 240, and really for anyone, it's easy to kind of get long and out of sync, but he's long had this really uniquely compact and kind of explosive operation. He stays really tight. He rotates really well. He's a near impossible at bat for opposing pitchers to have to navigate. And he's kind of shown that in pro ball as well. And he was a steady performer in single A Stockton. And then they bumped him up to double A Midland, where had a solid 5-game sample, went 4-for-13 with a double. And then he's done nothing but hit in the Arizona Fall League. He hit 354 with 2 doubles, 2 triples, jeez, 2 home runs and 11 RBIs in 12 games. And for a recent draft, for anyone, that's really impressive, but especially for a recent draftee. And with Kurtz, I mean, you've got plus hit, plus power. And I think what might get overlooked with him, and it's kind of a commonality to write it off a little bit with someone who's like a first base profile, is his defense. Like, he's a legitimate plus defender over there. He's super nimble, moves really well around the bag. He's outstanding over there and is as close to an impact defender at first base as I think you can get. And we saw it once in the Arizona Fall League, but in a real pinch, he moves well enough where he could handle an outfield spot for a game, and they stuck him out there for a game. So
yeah, the statistical results have been really loud. The under the hood batted ball data has been really impressive. I mean, he had the best among draftees with at least 50 plate appearances. His 109.4 90th percentile exit velocity was the best of, I think it's 158. Well, it's not 158. It's 158 total players we have data for, but of this 50 plus plate appearance sample, it's 128 hitters. He's first among those. The miss rates are solid. The end zone miss rates are great. The chase rates are great. I think leading up to the draft, there was a bit of hesitation with me for both of the college first basemen, just because the track record of college first basemen taken this high is just not good. Kurtz also had the injury questions. I think those were the two big questions for him, is just the injuries he's dealt with and the history of his specific profile. And so far, he's already kind of avoided the Jacob Berry gets a pro ball and immediately we wonder, okay, like, where's all the hitting we thought you had in college? He's kind of just continued to be that hitter. And so I'm just a lot more encouraged by that and confident moving forward that he's going to be this middle of the order bat. And I mean, we haven't even talked about some of the other really impressive hitters in this class, but if there's any player you want to go to first, Peter, please.
Yeah, I think with Kurtz, like, the key is going to be still staying on the field. I think he dealt with an injury. I'm not sure what it was, but he dealt with an injury this summer as well that kind of held him out. But Joshua Kuroda Grauer, who they got in the third round, 75th overall, another college performer that has hit the ground, I'd say, running, if not sprinting in pro ball, another rapid ascender. He was up to Triple-A by season's end, but he hit 428 at Rutgers. It's without a doubt a hit over power profile, but the contact skills are double plus. And I think across his from what I could gather on Synergy across his pro debut across all levels, it was a 94% in zone contact rate. So a guy with a big time knack for moving the baseball, it's always going to be extra base hit power, mm-hmm. over the fence power. But the hit tool is real. And I'm curious to see how he does across a full season and a full sample.
Yeah.
To see,
go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, if he's able to continue to hit enough to compensate for the lack of power, because I think defensively as well, mm-hmm. he probably fits best at second base long term. I know they gave him some significant run at shortstop in high A, but I think as a big leaguer, he'd be a second baseman.
Yeah, between Kuroda Grauer and Nick Kurtz, the A's had two of the 10 best hitting debuts among draftees. I mean, he stood out as one of the best pure contact hitters in the draft class so far with both in zone and overall contact rates. He was one of three players in this class to already push to AAA, which is just kind of shocking in general. So that one is looking good in the third round. They did take two high school players inside the top 10 rounds, so I'll briefly mention both of those players. Josiah Romeo, right-handed pitcher out of Canada, one of a handful of Canadian prospects. He has a multi-sport background as a basketball player, projectable frame, 6'3", 190 pounds, fastball that's typically in the low 90s, but's touched 94, 95. Some inconsistent secondaries that have flashed. The slider has added a bit of power. It's been in the mid-90s at times. The changeup is around 80. I got to see him at the draft combine and the stuff looks solid. I think he got hit around a little bit and I think there's some tweaks he can make delivery wise. But some interesting pitches to work with. And then Dylan Fien in the seventh round, catcher out of California. He's a big physical 6'3", 205 pound switch hitter who I think stands out more for his offensive tools than his defensive skills right now. There were some questions about whether or not he moves off the position and plays first, but he's got a ton of raw power. Maybe with some refinement on his pure hitting chops, he can tap into that in game. But those are two of the five high school players we'll talk about in the top 10 rounds today. So nice to see that they didn't just go with the safe college performing demographic, even though all five of their 1 million plus signing profiles fit that category. Although I don't know if you'd say that's like Rodney Green. He's got a little bit more tools and athleticism and a little bit more risk than some of their other college profiles.
Yeah, that was an 80 grade transition by you, because he was the next guy I was planning on talking about anyways. But with Rodney Green, like you hinted at, from a tool standpoint, I mean, it's really, really loud. And the fact they were able to mm-hmm. get him in the fourth round, I think that's a great spot to get Rodney Green. They got him with their fifth pick. The key with him and the question with him has long been, like, is he going to be able to hit enough and put the ball in play enough for him to maximize the tools that he's got? It was a down year at Cal. Mm-hmm. He had, I think, just 267 with 72 Ks and 206 at bats, but it was a really encouraging pro debut for him. He hit 289 with 8 doubles, 3 home runs, 21 RBIs and 9 stolen bases in 24 games. And he was able to move the baseball enough to get to the loud tools that he does have. And mm-hmm. the swing decisions I thought were fine. I mean, he chased it only a 21% overall clip. There was a little bit more of a expanding of the zone against spin. And then an overall miss rate of 28%, which is down from the spring at Cal. But I mean, it's a really easy swing, handsy swing from the left side with big time buggy whip. I mean, he just kind of flicks the ball all mm-hmm. around the yard. There's all fields impact plus runner. He can really go and get it in center field. It's like tools on tools. He's got a great body. Again, mm-hmm. the key for him going forward is just going to be hitting enough and putting the ball in play enough to maximize those tools.
Yeah. He reminds me a little bit of Judd Fabian in some ways, because he has power and he has a good approach at the plate and he'll walk a lot. Like, he never walked less than 12.7% of the time in college at California, was consistently posting high on base numbers, but he also never hit above 300. So it's just contact issues with him. And that was the same sort of player you saw in pro ball. It was a 28% miss rate. The zone miss is a little bit higher, not a little bit, maybe a lot higher than you want to see, but really impressive chase rate overall, impressive exit velocity numbers. When he hits the ball, it's going to go a long ways, and he does project to stick in center field as a plus runner. So just kind of a interesting profile. I'm not sure how much more contact you can add to Green moving forward, like if there's a mechanical tweak just to help him find a little bit more of the barrel or what, but it's a high upside pick for sure.
Yeah, ceiling is really high. I think with him, it's just pitch recognition issues and picking up spin out of the hand. Like, that's going to be, I'd say, the biggest key for him. But I mean, it is a really like loose and easy and impressive operation. So it's super easy hand speed. And again, he just flicks baseballs all around the yard. So he's just got to hit enough. And I guess, speaking of college guys who did perform at a higher clip, Tommy White was another guy who I'd say was a rather polarizing profile in the lead up to the draft, just with where, you know, various people had him projected and slotted. You and I, again, were not the conductors per se of the Tommy White train. It's just like, again, with guys that perform at such a high level, whether it's Christian Moore or others, it's hard to kind of look at and pay attention to the warts that they have kind of in the moment. And like Jack Caglione's another one where, you know, there were hit tool questions. But with Tommy White, he was another guy who we had kind of tabbed and picked out as, you know, as someone with potential hit tool questions just going forward, just given the aggressiveness that he has and the chase rate. Like, it was an overall 34% chase rate at LSU. It was even higher if you focus just alone on spin. And then his pro debut with single A Stockton was, I'd say, more modest. It certainly wasn't up to what Rodney Green was doing, and it was a 39% chase rate and a 29% miss rate.
Yeah, that miss rate being higher than Rodney Green is what maybe would be a little concerning, because the whole thing with Tommy White was he was really aggressive, but he had great bat to ball skills. He made a lot of contact. And if you have just that poor of chase and that poor of contact, that's just not a good combination to have. So if he can rediscover a little bit more contact moving forward, that would be encouraging. He's definitely a risk to move to first base. I mean, I kind of liked the pick where he was in the second round after you take a guy like Kurtz. Where I was a little concerned was like in that like first round range, what sort of profile you're getting. Yeah. But we'll see what happens with him.
Yeah, and I think with White, like the troubling thing is like the bat to ball skills were above average, if not plus, at LSU. I think his in zone contact rate was 86%, but in his pro debut, it was just 79% and 75% against fastballs. Like, he's just not hitting. And I'm curious to watch it going forward, but like you said, where it was lower than someone like Rodney Green, and again, it's across a limited sample, but we're looking at a guy who's probably going to end up as a right first baseman eventually. Like, you're going to have to bang, and he's off to a slower start. So that's another guy to kind of keep a close eye on.
Tommy White's offense is going to just live and die with his contact quality, because he's never been a guy who's had much in the way of like cushion with his on base by walking much. It's between a 7% and 9% walk rate in his career in college, which it's hard to see that just jumping against pro pitching.
Oh yeah. I mean, he's in the box, he's swinging, he's not looking to take walks. And I think that's a really hard habit to kind of break and get out of, especially when it's such a key component of Tommy White's game and kind of makes him who he is as a hitter. So
he was swinging nearly 56% of the time in his pro debut, which is about what I would have expected, but quite high for just a general swing rate.
Yeah. But I guess going from sour to sweet, a pick that I really did like was their third pick, Engage Jump, from LSU. Long been a famous name dating back to his high school days, missed all of 23 with an injury, but bounced back last year with LSU. And was a key part of their staff. 3.4 ERA with 101 Ks and 83 innings. Some funk to his delivery, a shorter arm action, fastball up into the mid to upper 90s with over 20 inches of carry through the zone, and then mixes in two distinct breaking balls, and both, I'd say, are above average, with the curveball potentially being a plus pitch. He went to his slider more, and it was plenty effective last year, but there are a lot of really fun traits with Jump. He's relatively low mileage arm, good athlete with strikes and stuff. I think that, you know, he checks a lot of boxes, and Getting him where they did was, I'd say, fairly decent value, and I'd say worth the almost $1 million in overslot money they gave him.
Yep, good one to finish on. Let's get into the Mariners. They drafted 15th overall. One of the more top-heavy classes we'll talk about, just given the strategy they employed. They took Gerangelo Sancha, a switch pitcher out of Mississippi State, in the first round. In the second round, they went with high school right-handed pitcher Ryan Sloan. In the third round, they took Kansas right-handed pitcher Hunter Cranton. In the fourth round, they took Nebraska catcher Josh Caron. And then in the fifth round, they took Duke right-handed pitcher Charlie Bielenson. They paid a lot of money for Ryan Sloan in the second round. He got more than $1 million over slot value with that second round pick, essentially paid as first round money. $3 million signing bonus, $1.35 million more than slot value at that 55th overall pick. But in doing so, they got a pair of players who we ranked inside the top 30, two first round talents. One of the better college pitchers on the board after the top two were gone. And then Ryan Sloan just had a tremendous spring and was kind of surging on boards and wound up in position where, if you wanted to make the case that he was maybe the best high school right-handed pitcher or high school pitcher in the class, I think there's a pretty compelling case to do so. Then after that, the Mariners were aggressive in targeting seniors to make up for the signing bonus that they would need for Ryan Sloan there. So they were really aggressive and not just like non-prospect seniors, but there were some priority seniors with real tools, real skills, real stuff. Hunter Cranton has a big fastball. Grant Nipp is a really compelling two-way player in the sixth round, but they had six total college seniors inside the top 10 rounds. A very, I don't know if I'd say it's risky or unique, but maybe a little bit of an unorthodox draft class, but one I'm kind of excited by, just given the firepower of the top two arms. Peter, where are you at with the Mariners?
Yeah, I'm with you. The two arms are going to serve as a really good anchor, I think, to the class. And Sancha is such a unique profile where he's a he'll throw with from both the right and the left side. I'm curious to see, like, going forward, I find it hard to imagine that, like, he's the stuff and velo is way better from the right side. Like, from a matchup standpoint, he's fine from the left side. I'm curious to see if they just have him ditch the left side altogether. But it is so
unique. I hope not. Just because, yeah, it's just such an unusual trait and ability. And I don't really want him pitching like a large volume. Like I don't even want him pitching against every left-handed hitter as a left-handed pitcher. But I think there are definitely situations where I hope he continues to change the glove and drop down a slider from the left side, because I think his fastball and slider can be effective to certain hitters
I was just going to say, I mean, I'd continue to let him do both. There's really no reason to have him stop unless it, for some reason, it severely hinders his development. I don't see why it would, but I'd say excited as I get about, you know, college guys, getting Ryan Sloan 55th overall for almost double the slot value. That's an A pick for me. I mean, as you said, he was one of the better high school pitchers during the spring season. It's a plus fastball. It's up to nine. It's just really powerful electric stuff through and through. It's a plus fastball that sits in the mid 90s up to 99. It's a plus slider. You probably stick a 55, at least I would, at least on the changeup. It's a really intriguing pitch mix. He's got a workhorse physical body. Who I think, you know, he has a really good chance, I think, to start, and just given Seattle's development track record, especially on the pitching side, like, this could be kind of their next guy in line who is a potential rotation headliner. I know that's a really bullish summary to give, but I do feel that strongly about Sloan.
I feel like if you're Ryan Sloan after you get picked in this year's draft, you have to feel pretty good about your future, regardless of whether or not you know you're going to sign. If your options are Wake Forest or the Seattle Mariners as a pitcher, like, you're in pretty good hands regardless of where you go. And I'm also pretty excited about Ryan Sloan. You mentioned it, but it's a lot of physicality. It's power to the fastball. It's a slider that's a high spin pitch that he has really great feel to land and looked sharper this spring. It's a changeup that is an above average offering. Maybe that's a third plus pitch. And really tying it all together is solid control and command. I think his touch and feel for all three of those pitches was really encouraging. There's not really an area of his game where I'm like, oh, you really need to improve here. It's more of a case that he just kind of needs to go out and do it in pro ball. There's not a specific part of his game that I'm super worried about at this point. I mean, he's not particularly old for the class. I think the body's good. I think he moves well. It's a deep mix for high school pitcher. Just checks all the boxes for me.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on Sloan. I think with Cranton in the third round, it's another no doubt. Well, not another, but it's a no doubt reliever type. Screams fast mover, fastball, slider are both plus. Mm-hmm. I think you make the argument it's up to 100 with, and it's a lively 100 too. It's got some carry through the zone, and it's a power slider that, you know, has this sharp two plane tilt to it. It's effective against righties and lefties. He had a solid pro debut. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of in, like, they went with at least what I thought after Cintra and Sloan with almost like no doubt reliever archetypes. Like Brock Moore in the seventh is a really, I'd say, a little bit similar to Cranton, like another uber powerful arm. He's up to 100. Mm-hmm. It's like it relies really heavily on the fastball, but it'll mix in a slider.
Yeah, kind of old guy with big arm strength that you think is going to fit in the pen. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like 24-year-old guy, big time arm strength, power arm, no doubt reliever, with, you know, premium velo with stuff to boot. And then with Grant Nipp, I know that as a hitter was outstanding at Campbell, but I am curious to see like if he ends up on the mound long term, because he threw like 5 2/3 innings at Campbell. They stuck him on the mound during their fall scout day. He's up to 98. It's like big time arm strength. I think that there might be more there by the way of upside on the mound than there is at the plate with Nipp.
I would agree. I think there's definitely more upside for him on the mound than as a hitter. The numbers at Campbell are good, but I know there was a lot of skepticism among scouts about like what the true hitting ability was going to be for him. There was a lot of concern that he wasn't going to stick behind the plate as a catcher. So I think there's probably just more upside that can be coaxed out of him on the mound. Another pitcher I think that has a lot of upside on the mound, and maybe the Mariners can help him unlock it a little bit more, is Christian Little in the 11th round. I thought this was a really interesting pick and organization fit, just given what the Mariners have done with arms, because Christian Little is a guy who's just shown really impressive pure stuff going back to his high school days. He enrolled early at Vanderbilt, transferred to LSU later, and never really figured it all out. I mean, it's always been a fastball that's kind of sitting in the mid 90s, up to 99, 100. He's thrown a cutter, he's thrown a curveball, he's thrown a slider, he's thrown a changeup. Like all these pitches have flashed really solid, but he never can put it together. The strikes have always been kind of lacking. It's probably most likely that he fits as a reliever, but he's still reasonably young for how long he's been kind of around college. And I just feel like if we have another pitcher like Alejandro Rosario who just goes into pro ball and takes a step forward with some really good pro pitching development, Christian Little would be a player that at least has a lot of upside for where you're getting him in the 11th round, signing him for $200,000. There's risk here, certainly, but I mean, he looks the part, he's got a good frame. That's just a fascinating one. And this is a pretty pitcher heavy class for Seattle, which I know some people don't like in general. You want to stock up on hitters and maybe get pitchers later on. But I think for an organization that has a reputation of developing arms, I kind of like when teams just add a lot of ammunition to their development groups that are kind of have a track record of doing that. So I don't mind it. There were just two hitters drafted inside the top 10 rounds, Josh Caron in the fourth, and then Anthony D'Onofrio in the 10th. So it was a little bit difficult to fill out Seattle's offensive categories on their draft report card, but no shortage of options for various pitching tools.
Yeah, and I not to continue to go on with Seattle, but with I think you brought up a great point with Little. Like, there's always been stuff. He's had a big arm. It's just like he's kind of yet to put it all together outside of his sophomore year, really, at Vanderbilt. But I'm with you that, like, he is, and getting him in the 11th round, I think that, you know, it's good value in the 11th. Give him $200,000. And then with Seattle as well, that's a fun mix. And I think they can maximize his stuff. And I also think body wise, I think to phrase it nicely, you got a little too physical in his transfer to LSU. Like, I think that you can slim him down a little bit, make him more of an efficient mover on the mound. But like you said, the stuff's there. I'm actually really intrigued by his high 80s to low 90s cutter. Like, I think that there's like, that could be a real weapon for him. It's already proven to be, but I think if they can hone in on that further, like, that could be like his bread and butter type pitch. But he's up to 99 this past spring. Another intriguing one. And then Charlie Bjelanson in the fifth round, another really like no doubt reliever, but the changeup is comfortably plus, if not double plus, certainly closer to a 70 than it is a 60. Fastball up to 96, just again fits in that archetype of potentially fast moving reliever, really effective late inning option. And then the one hitter that they took inside the top five rounds was Josh Caron from Nebraska. Intriguing impact at the plate. I think he posted a max EV of 114.4, 114.5 at Nebraska. Gap to gap juice at a solid pro debut. So another one to watch.
Yep. All right. Well, we're nearing the hour mark of the pod. We'll move into our final team here. And that's the Rangers picking at the very back of the first round at pick 30. With that pick, they went with Stanford catcher Malcolm Moore. In the second round, they took Tennessee outfielder Dylan Dreiling. In the third round, they took North Carolina outfielder Casey Cook. In the fourth round, they took West Virginia right-handed pitcher David Hageman. And then in the fifth round, they took another high school player, one of our last high school players we'll touch on in today's episode, Stoneman Douglas High shortstop Devin Fitzgerald, the Florida powerhouse Stoneman Douglas. His father was a coach on that team. His older brother played college baseball, and I believe is in a minor league org somewhere at this point.
He's with Seattle High, I believe.
Yeah, there we go. So baseball family for Devin Fitzgerald. But what are your thoughts on the Rangers draft class, Peter? A little bit more hitter heavy at the top with a lot of players that I think have a chance to be maybe above average pure hitters in pro ball.
Yeah, I think Dylan Dreiling was a guy that saw his draft stock, like a lot of guys on that Tennessee team did, quite frankly, just continue to rise over the course of the spring. He was a draft eligible sophomore, hit 342 with 19 doubles and 23 jacks. It was a really, I'd say, intriguing hit power blend. I think his max EV at school was 113 with solid contact skills and a good approach with polished swing decisions. He kind of flashed the same in his pro debut, even though the numbers might not necessarily jump off the page. I think he hit sub 200 and didn't hit for a lot of power, but ran a 96% overall in zone contact rate, chased it just a tick over 20%. And this was in high A. So I think that there are some positive building blocks to build off of with Dreiling. And then with Malcolm Moore, it was a little bit of a struggle for him. I think that they also sent him to high A Hickory. Yeah, they sent him right to high A Hickory. At Stanford, I think that the numbers in the back of the baseball card numbers tell a little bit of a different story than how he actually did. Like, it wasn't as bad of a season, I don't think, as it looks on paper, where he hit 255, but he struck out a little bit, and there were some swing and miss issues, I think, in high A with Hickory, but he did get to that impact and that pull side impact that's kind of long been his calling card. Like, it's such a unique operation for him in the box. I'm curious to see how they potentially tweak and clean that up going forward. Like, there are a lot of moving parts. It's almost this like continued toe tap. He starts basically not square to the pitcher, but with a
nearly, you know, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see how they deal with that going forward, if they deal with that at all, what they clean up. But there is pull side power. And then defensively, it's kind of, it's an area to monitor of Moore's game, just kind of how he progresses behind the plate. That was kind of the one knock on him was the defensive ability. So I'm curious to see if he does enough to stick back there. I'm not totally sold, but
I would think of guys like maybe Austin Wells as a player with a similar amateur reputation as a defender behind the plate, as a player to look at if you're optimistic about him sticking or how he can improve. Like, Wells just really improved a lot as a receiver and a framer. You can kind of get away with some of his other limitations behind the plate if Moore is able to do that. I think his arm is already better than what Austin Wells had really throughout his amateur career. But one player I want to mention here is Casey Cook. I mean, he was just a really advanced hitter at North Carolina, probably the best pure hitter on the North Carolina team. this year that also included Vance Honeycutt, who is kind of the antithesis of Casey Kutt. Honeycutt is all tools, athleticism, uber upside, and real hit questions. And Cook is kind of just this steady eddy, sweet swinging, left-handed hitting outfielder who makes a lot of contact, hits for high average. He did tap into more power in 2024 than he previously had. 18 home runs this spring. I wouldn't anticipate he's a huge power guy in pro ball. The exit velocities in his pro debut aren't super loud, anything to really get excited about. And he's not a guy who's going to wow you with his speed or his defense or his arm, but you're looking at a guy in the third round. You're not getting an above average hitter who's super tooled up at that stage, but I think he's a guy who could just be a really reliable, solid in most areas and carried by just a really impressive knack for hitting. It's a clean, easy swing. There's not a lot of effort. I think his pitch recognition has always been pretty solid. He can use the entire field. So that's a bat I'm pretty intrigued by in the third round. I think we had him in like the 150 to 200 range on our board, but maybe he'll add some strength and surprise me in the power department.
Yeah, I'm with you on Cook. Like you said, it's performance over tools, but again, he kind of fits for me in that DGP bucket where he's damn good player, like just a really good baseball player. And it's hit over power, performance over tools, but like you said, just kind of a steady performer and really broke out as a junior at UNC, and curious to see how he does going forward. David Hageman from West Virginia is a, I'd say really interesting arm, power arm that's kind of just steadily ticked up velo and stuff wise throughout his career, at West Virginia. And last year he was up to 98 life through the zone. I think the heater didn't get a whole lot of miss, but like there are traits there under the hood where you can kind of, you know, potentially optimize the location of it and maybe tinker with the shape a little bit to maximize its effectiveness. It's a really effective power slider and he didn't throw it a lot. But his changeup, I think, also is a budding third pitch. So I'm kind of curious to see if they give him a chance to start at least early on, but I think at worst, you're looking at a really effective bullpen arm with kind of this potentially plus. I'd say the fastball right now is definitely a 55, not a 6, but slider, you could certainly make the argument as a 55 at least as well with this really effective two-pitch mix as a bullpen guy. And then they took Rafe Parrish in the 7th round, kind of this another data darling type guy, just played 9 games in his pro debut. He went just 3 for 25, which obviously isn't super encouraging, but it's such a small sample, it's hard to put much, if any, stock into it. I think the key with Parrish is going to be like a slight tweak in his swing. He hit the ball on the ground a lot at Lehigh, but there is legit impact there and potentially power upside. I think his max EV was 115 at Lehigh as a zone contact rate of, I believe last year at Lehigh, it was 95%, including 97% against fastballs. Really polished and impressive approach with advanced swing decisions. He chased it just a 17% overall clip. He's got a strong arm over a third. Big physical kid at 6'3", 225. So I'm curious to see if they can, you know, potentially optimize his swing a little bit more. And that would really help maximize his offensive ceiling. So that's another guy that I'm kind of intrigued by and going to keep a close eye on going forward.
Yeah, two performers I'll mention from this draft class early on, probably the better performers from Texas's class so far. Ben Hartle in the 14th round. He led all Texas hitters in OPS in his debut, 928 OPS split between low A Down East and Triple A Round Rock. It was just a handful of games at Round Rock, but he got a couple hits between both levels. He hit 333, 474, 452 with a homer and a pair of doubles. Anthony Susak in the 8th round. He is the cousin of former A's first rounder Daniel Susak, who's a primetime catcher coming out of the draft. But Susak, I mean, this is not a class that has a lot of high octane fastballs. I think Susak maybe has a case for one of the better fastballs in this draft class. It's 93-94, solid ride and extension, has been up to 97 in the past. It was more of a ground ball offering in college. I'm curious how it's going to play moving forward in pro ball, but it was a good debut, 9.1 innings. He didn't allow an earned run, 12 strikeouts, 6 walks. So he's kind of an intriguing arm in the 8th round, signed for $200,000. He's got a slider in the mid-80s. He's got a changeup and a curveball. I'm assuming he's a reliever moving forward, but that's kind of an interesting name at the back of this day two section.
Yeah, I'm happy you brought him up. I caught him a few times on the Cape before the draft, and he was really good in his stint out there. He had a 2.9 ERA, 20 Ks, and 12 and a third innings, and he carried that over to pro ball, as you said. Really strong pro debut. I think his fastball on the Cape was up to, as you said, 97. It was good in the top of the zone. Slider was an effective off-speed, definite reliever profile, but a good one at that, at least looking like it early on.
Yeah, I really wish the Rangers could have signed 19th rounder Cade Obermüller. Maybe it was at this point we should have assumed he was getting back to school, but you've seen some college players sign in this range in the 20 round draft, but we had him as a top 200 prospect in the class. Low arm slot left-hander, small and skinny type, works off of a two-pitch mix, mostly a fastball in the low 90s and a slider. I think it was Walker Yannick who mentioned him being one of the more difficult ABs he faced in the draft. It's just such an unusual look. Everything he throws has horizontal movement. It's tough to barrel up. So that would have been a fun addition to the back of this draft class. But I guess you're not signing him in the 19th round these days.
Yeah, I'll actually do you one more than Walker Yannick, because Travis Bezzana actually also said it was his toughest at bat that he had on the Cape.
There you go.
So like you said, just really difficult look, especially for lefties. But
you're saying also, Travis Bezzana is a better hitter than Walker Yannick, Peter? How dare you?
I know. But yeah, like you said, it's a really difficult look from the left side, low three-quarter slot. Fastball jumps out of his hand. Sweeping sliders are really, I'd give it a plus grade, but getting him back to Iowa is a major win. So all signs point to him going pretty good this July.
All right, Peter, which of these draft classes most excite you? Which one are you grabbing if you can take one?
It's a good question. I don't think that, unlike in past weeks that we've covered, there hasn't really been one that stood out to me a whole lot. I actually really like Oakland's class, especially in the top 10 rounds. Right? I'm kind of leaning towards Oakland.
Yeah, that was me as well. I hate to be boring and pick the same as you, but I was kind of just tabbing through them all again. Some of these, I just wish I had some more confidence in the bats. And with Oakland, they have a couple of not only high performers, but guys I think have exciting tool sets, like Rodney Green in the fourth round. I like that. I like the fact that there's some high school upside and longer term plays for a little bit of diversification. But I think Nick Kurtz just might be the best player of this this division, and really liked him before the draft. He's only kind of continued to meet our expectations and prove that he's a really strong hitter moving forward. Gage Jump is a nice little addition. Carter Grauer moving so quickly and having the contact skills. I think I'm also leaning Oakland on this one.
Yeah. No, I'll go Oakland, and I think it also helps that a lot of the picks that we've talked about are performing well so far. So that also plays in their favor, but it was a really intriguing crop, especially in days one and two.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Anything you want to plug before we get out of here for today?
Yeah. The initial signing day rankings for the 2025 college recruiting classes are up on the site right now. It's a pretty beefy 5,000 plus word piece, but it's a lot of in-depth info with some video to boot. So that's up there. Draft podcast will be available every Friday going forward, and then each day now, really for the foreseeable future, you're going to get a top 10 with best tools included and a chat on every system in baseball. So while it might be the off season on the actual baseball calendar, there's a ton of great stuff every single day at Baseball America, whether it's on the amateur side, on the pro side, whatever you want. And if you want the full top 30 with even more in-depth reports, I'd encourage purchasing the prospect handbook, because that's where you'll find all that.
Yeah, that's a good sell. Can't really add too much to that. I guess I'll just mention, if you want any sort of rookie Sasaki coverage, we've got, like 15 different articles breaking down Sasaki, his stuff, who should sign him, implications on the international market, So that's kind of added some spice to the offseason, and it's been fun to see guys like JJ and Jeff and Ben breaking him down and providing analysis about one of the most exciting pitching prospects we've seen in some years. So plenty to look forward to over at Baseball America. Thank you guys for supporting us. If you do, thanks for listening to the show. Regardless, for Peter, I'm Carlos. We'll see you guys next week.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Think you know all about Cleveland? Think again and get ready to learn much more about Cleveland. Listen to the latest episodes of Destination Cleveland's podcast, Legends of the Land. We're talking to locals and experts to uncover answers to those burning questions we get asked about the land. Get the real story behind all things Cleveland, from its rich history to the hidden gems. There's so much to explore. Tune in on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you find your podcasts. Discover a side of Cleveland you never knew.